Welcome. This year's annual Hanukkah Masiba. Thank you everybody for coming, all those that work so hard on putting it together, all the Kol staff for all their dedication throughout the year, and particularly for this event, particularly Rabbi Schatz and Mrs. Sarah Malka Winter. Thank you to Rabbi Ryan, South Masiba congregation, for sharing their space and being such gracious hosts. And all the special people that we have with us this year. It's very special to have Rabbi Talbam, who's those that have tried to get him to speak know that it's very difficult because Rabbi Talbam is not only very, very busy, but commensurately humble, but the Kol has a little bit of an in. With Rabbi Talbam, we were zeichet to work together on different things, so it was very hard for Rabbi Talbam to escape us. Just one thought, Chanukah, Medina de Gemara, in the Talmud it says that you're actually supposed to light outside by the door. In times of sakana, danger, the Gemara says that's when we brought the Chanukah inside the house, because it's safe and sound over there, and the people that would provoke violence against the Jewish people just close the curtains, and they wouldn't have to see about it. And that's an interesting halachic discussion about nowadays what the status is, but we're not going to discuss that tonight. We all know that the menorah and the light in our midst of the Torah are is reminiscent and symbolic of the Torah. I was just thinking about Rabbi Talbam, that Rabbi Talbam embodies both the Torah of Chutz and the Torah of Bifnim. That inside, in our own sanctuaries, our own temples, our yeshivos, we're zocheh, we merit to have Rabbi Talbam's Torah, as well as Rabbi Talbam is courageous and intrepid enough to bring the Torah outside the home, into the dangerous outside, and to share his wisdom and Torah with so many people. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure that I have in introducing Rabbi Talbam.
I guess just thank you very much, Rabbi Winter, and thank you all for coming tonight. Not as part of my remarks, I did want to mention, as you mentioned, teaching the outside. Probably not a coincidence that Hanukkah is one of the few mitzvahs that it's not really a daytime mitzvah or a nighttime mitzvah. It seems to fit into that quasi, maybe Dan HaShemashah zone. Yes, we know halachically we're supposed to light, but it seems to always fall out during this time frame. I don't think it's a coincidence. The Gemara Benachas tells us, in fact, that the Gemara asks, when are you supposed to study Chachmas Chitzonis? When are you supposed to study the laws, the wisdom of the outside world? After all, it says, V'gisa b'yem v'loyli, you're supposed to study Torah day and night. So the Gemara says, Bein HaShemashos, it's not day or night, it's a special time called Bein HaShemashos, and that's the time one can study and dedicate for Chachmas Chitzonis. The main explanation of what that means, I certainly don't believe it's a coincidence that we dafka light the menorah, which prevents the Or HaTorah, specifically during the Bein HaShemashos, which is Chachmas Yevonis, obviously, that we're empowered over Hanukkah, Dafka, to bring that light into the street as well. I don't want to interject a somber note before we begin, but I do want to say that the month of Kislev and Hanukkah Befrat is a month of Nisan, and all those that need Nisan and Yeshuas in our community and wherever else, we hope that this show will maybe be a little bit of a schus to them as well. Tell a story about this little old lady, gets on a plane, sits next to this big, hunking, tall, blonde guy, blue-eyed fellow. She looks him up and down for a little bit and says to him, you know, are you Jewish? And he looks at her like, what? She goes, are you Jewish? So he says, no. Oh, a few minutes later, looks at me and goes, are you sure you're not Jewish? So he goes, I'm not Jewish. A few minutes later, she persists. She goes, are you sure you're not Jewish? Maybe your father, your mother, somebody's Jewish. Nobody's Jewish. 15 minutes later, same question. Are you sure you're not Jewish? She goes, okay, I'm Jewish, my father's Jewish, everyone's Jewish. So she looks at him, she goes, really? You don't look Jewish.
The truth is,
it's a sad but true story that really brings us to the Yom Tov of Hanukkah, where the Jews perhaps try to see Jewishness in the Greek world as well and try to convince themselves that what they were doing was actually something Jewish. We know that the time of Hanukkah story, there were many Yisavnim, according to most historical accounts, maybe 40% of all Jews, so to speak, converted. They convinced themselves that they shared enough ground with the Greeks, there was enough commonality that they could embrace Greek culture and discard their own. But we'll see shortly that they were able to somehow rediscover their own life from within. It's interesting. In the Alan Nisim, that we say, Hanukkah, so Alan Nisim, Val Purkan, Val Vuros, Val Chuos, and Mechamais, the miracles, the Purkan, the salvation, the Gvuros, the Chuos. So these are all things we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for, the victories, etc. Everyone asked the question, many people asked the question, the word Purkan is an Aramaic word. It doesn't seem to belong in the text that's specifically a Hebrew text. Nisim, Gvuros, Chuos, Purkan is Aramaic. The B'nai Yisrael, who maybe some of you are familiar with, wrote prolifically on the Yom Tov of Hanukkah. Interesting sidebar, a side story. If you ever read his Torah on Hanukkah, it's le'elu le'elu, far beyond everything else that he wrote. And he wants to ask the Chozer, his Rebbe, the Chozer Lublin, why is it that he has such a natural affinity for the Yom Tov of Hanukkah? And the Chozer, the word Chozer means seer, the Chozer could see things you and I couldn't see. And the Chozer told him something, again, it's kind of just kind of beyond my pay scale, but I'm going to repeat the story anyway. The Chozer said something like, well, I know that your neshama is a gilgul, is a reincarnation of one of the members of Sanhedrin that will convey you the Yom Tov of Hanukkah, and that's why you have this special affinity. I mentioned that to you because I'm going to mention maybe one or two ideas from B'nai Yisrael over the course of my talking now, but the B'nai Yisrael had this real tremendous insight, and maybe even now I could say inside scoop into Hanukkah as well. And he says, and this is a larger thing that he says, but I'm giving you this to the abbreviated version. He says that Aramaic in general is an imprint of Lashon Kodesh. It's not quite Lashon Kodesh, but it's what he calls a roshem. There's an impression of Lashon Kodesh in the Aramaic language. And he says that Hanukkah, we have to understand, Hanukkah left this imprint. The word furkan, which means salvation, but it's used in the context, or rather with the word furkan in Aramaic, specifically to convey that Hanukkah left its impression. The story didn't just happen then, but it's something that applies today. The Hanukkah impression is something that we feel to this very day. Why the word Purkan specifically, he goes into that, not for now. But bottom line, we have to realize that the Hanukkah story left this impression today. We have to see out exactly what that impression is. As I mentioned, the Jews found themselves gravitating towards the Greek culture, and the Greeks certainly embraced and encouraged them to shed their own identity and become part of the Greek culture. In fact, Timu Kala Shmanim, some of the Sfarim learn that Shema in oil, we know, is something that automatically separates from water. And Timu Kala Shmanim means that the Greeks were metame, they try to impure the oil, they try to separate, they try to undo the power of the Shema, so to speak. They try to, even though Shema is a natural separation from water, they try to break that natural separation that there ought to be between the Jews and the rest of the world, and they try to break that down. While we're talking about the Alan Nisim, just two other phrases I'd like to discuss. One is the words Lashkicham Torah Secha. We say the Avonim, in their attempt to Timma Shmanim, which is again now to break down that barrier that Shemen seems to represent, Lashkicham Torah Secha, to make us forget our Torah, which itself is something that we need to understand. How do you make someone forget something? How do you make someone forget something? The more you tell that person to forget it, that's when they're going to remember it. So how do the Greeks attempt Lashkicham to make them forget their Torah? And towards the end of the Al Nisim, now we know there's an Al Nisim for Hanukkah, there's an Al Nisim for Purim. And they pretty much run parallel, Bimei Matasyo, Bimei Marachav Esther, Bikish Vahashmid, Kisham de Machas Yavan, and there are parallels that run through. But the ending is not quite the same way. The Marachan has to end a story of and the Alisim ends. They hung him up, him and his sons in a tree, end the conversation. The story is over when they hang him up. The Al Nisa of Hanukkah ends the Kavu Shmorim of Hanukkah Lula Hoyz Halishim Chagadol, that we or the Chazal at that time established the 8-day Yontif called Hanukkah. If there would be a parallel, we would expect that in Purim it's the same thing also. That Kavu, that Chazal then Marcha Esther also would convey a Yontif of Purim following the great miracle of Purim, but we don't find that parallel. The question is why we don't find that parallel. There's a riddle, I think by the Ibn Ezra, if I'm not mistaken. The Ibn Ezra asks an interesting riddle. He says, where do you find that when the master falls, we don't rush to pick him up, but if a servant falls, we rush to pick him up? That was the question that he posed, and maybe some of you heard this, maybe hopefully some of you are thinking now. I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with Hanukkah. All right, that should be a good hint. And what it really has to do with the fact is that the Shamish represents the servant. When it's falls, we rush to pick it up because we need the Shamash to serve the rest of the lights, and we don't want to get hanav, get any pleasure from the rest of the lights. Whereas if the light itself falls down, the master, so to speak, because the Shamash is serving the master, the light, the Shamash light is serving the other candles. If that would fall down, we know the halacha is kufs ein zakut. We know the law is that when you light the menorah, the Hanukkah menorah, if the light happens to go out, we're not required to relight it. Which in itself is hard to understand. The whole story is about Pesumi Nisa, about spreading the information and the miracle of Hanukkah. One would expect that you should be obligated to relight the menorah, but we're not obligated. So it's an interesting case where when the servant falls, we pick him up. We rush to pick up the shamus. See, if you come late, you get stuck up front. That's the way it goes. Right. So the question is, you know, why is it, in fact, that the shamus, when it falls, we rush to pick it up? Seems odd that when the master falls, we don't pick it up. The Yom Tovim of the year, including the Torah Yom Tovim, seem to parallel different phases of a person's life. The first Yom Tov, the first holiday we have is Pesach, then we have Shavuos, we have Sukkot. And they seem to run parallel to the different phases of a person's life. The first phase of a person's life is when he's born, Pesach, the birth of the Jewish people. Shavuos, we got the mitzvah, that became our bar mitzvah, if you will. Sukkot, sit under the canopy of a chuppah, on the canopy of the sukkah, and that, the Sfarim tell us, really represents the marriage. So you have birth, bar mitzvah, and marriage. And then the question becomes, the next holiday coming up is Hanukkah. What does that represent? The truth is, it really represents the midlife crisis. Hanukkah is, after the marriage, there might be a time where that relationship seems to lose its energy, lose its magic, lose its enthusiasm, and that really was what Hanukkah took place. Hanukkah took place when there was kind of a midlife crisis. The Jews lost their bearings, they lost their way, they lost their relationship from Tosh, they lost their enthusiasm for the relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that really became the story, the message of Hanukkah. So how do they regain faith in their marriage, so to speak? So let's talk about what it means to make someone forget your Torah. What did the Greeks actually try to do? We all know that the Greeks, they marveled at our wisdom because they appreciated wisdom, and they even succeeded in translating our Torah into the Greek language. However, some tell us that it was really the written language that they admired, but the oral law in particular, they were very much opposed to. Most notably because the whole notion that the human mind could interface with God's wisdom was something that was foreign to them. It's something not only foreign to them, they rejected it out of hand as impossible. Never shall the twains meet. Can the human mind interface with something divine? And the oral law is really that area where we actually partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's wisdom and actually partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. We partner with God himself when we study his oral law, and then we produce through this partnership. In fact, this is Pasha coming up. We find a very interesting idea. We know that while the Greeks in general also wanted to oppose us in doing certain mitzvahs, Lavira Mechuke Ritanech is the first phrase. In particular, they oppose three mitzvahs: Chodesh, Mila, and Shabbos. Chodesh, Mila, and Shabbos. Chodesh is the opportunity that we have, the mitzvah that we have to declare the new moon. Mila is, we know, circumcision, and Shabbos is the mitzvah of Shabbos. They specifically chose those mitzvahs because those mitzvahs in particular really represent or highlight our partnership with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Chodesh, HaKadosh Baruch Hu waits for us. He says, whenever you declare the new moon, that's what the Yom Tov is going to be. We partner with Hashem with Chodesh. Mila is Hashem's way of saying, you have to help me out to complete the human being. It's not been complete by myself. I need you to help complete me. And so we partner with Hashem for Mila. And Shabbos, as I'll tell us, when the person keeps Shabbos, he becomes a shutef, becomes literally a partner with HaKadosh Baruch Hu with Maisa Bereishis. In this week's Torah portion, we find that Yosef, and we'll see later, he plays a major role in the Hanukkah theme. Yosef actually prepares the Jews, eventually, when they hunker down to Mitzrayim, and he uses the word Zechimesh as Eretz Mitzrayim. He prepares Mitzrayim. And the word Zechimesh actually is an acronym for Chodesh, Mila, and Shabbos. Benes also points out, because in a certain sense, he understood that he had to prepare for the all the Gullahs, including the exile of the Greeks. And so there's a remez, there's a hint to the word, or the Greek exile, the word Chimesh, but specifically the Greeks opposed this partnership that we have with Kadosh Baruch Hu. And that's where Klai Yisrael had to rediscover their energy. When the Greeks translated the Torah and put it in a bookshelf in a library, they attempted to have us forget our Torah. Why? You ever walk into a library? You're met with dead silence. It's dead. You walk into a Beis Medrash, you walk into the Kollel here, and you'll hear people yelling and screaming. They can barely contain themselves. There's an excitement. It's alive. Now, they tell the story about the two cities that were competing for a particular rabbi. Each one wanted that rabbi to be the rabbi in his town, and they offered various perks, competing perks, to convince the rabbi to come. Finally, one of the cities pointed out to the rabbi that their town has something very special going on, that some of the holiest rabbis of the previous generations are buried in their town. So that kind of tipped the scale. He couldn't resist the celebrity status. He heads over to that town, only to discover it's not true. No cemetery, no holy Jews buried there, and he's really upset. So he says, what's going on? They said, what we meant is those rabbis, their wisdom, their Torah, it's all buried here. Nobody remembers a word from their Torah. It's all buried. And the truth of the matter is, that Torah became dead because there was no exchange, there was no oral law, there was no way of us engaging and having a partnership. When we study Torah and we feel that we're partnering with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it becomes vibrant, it becomes alive. When you put it on a bookshelf, it becomes part of a library. And that's exactly what the Greeks wanted to do. The Greeks wanted to treat our Torah, like any other culture, a bookshelf on a library. The Tzarei Peh is that area, however, HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to partner with him, where we're able to feel this interface with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this interface with God, and feel the energy, feel the vibrancy, so that it stays alive. Lashkicham Torasecha, they wanted to make the Torah dead. When something is dead, you forget it. And they want to make it dead by denying us the very notion that we can connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu vis-a-vis the Torah. And that's why the Midrashim allude to the fact that the Torah, the Greeks burnt the Torah on a bridge. And what they mean by that is that the Torah could be a bridge to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that concept, that studying Torah could be a conduit to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it could be a conduit to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what they sought to deny, that's what they tried to impose upon us, that couldn't happen. And so, once we rediscovered the power of Torah, we rediscovered the enthusiasm, and the relationship came again back to its original glory. In fact, we emphasize the idea of hidur mitzvah. Now, it's interesting. We don't use the word chumma mitzvah or some form of that variation where we talk about being machmir, being extra strict. We use the word hidur. And one of the reasons from tells us is the word hidur also comes from the word hadar, which means to return. Because really, on Hanukkah, there was a return. We restored, number one, ourselves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and we'll see soon that we restored a specific light that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had hidden for us, we brought that back as well. But certainly Hanukkah is that story of us returning to our former glory by reuniting with the Torah in a way that engaged us with a passion. And so that rather than feeling this Torah was dead and could be forgotten, it now became alive. And that's why we end the Alanisim with the words, V'kavri shmashachar elu. Because the ultimate slam dunk, the ultimate victory against the Greeks was exactly that. That we partner with our Kaddish Baruch Hu, and we're able to create new Kiddush in the world. The concept of creating something new, something holy. A scientist, a secular mind, as the Greeks were, and the Greeks only dealt with that which is observable, in their world of observance, matter and their energy can neither be created nor destroyed. And yet we say we can create Kedusha. We can create more holiness. And so the ultimate slam dunk is that we were Kaveya Shmoyne Tachana Elu, that we established this holiday of 8 days. We invested the world with more holiness by declaring a new holiday. In fact, there's a Medrash that says that if somebody challenges rabbinic authority and says, what? Haneris Alolu, I don't want to light these Hanukkah candles. Haneris Kedushin, I don't believe in this. So the Gemara reminds us that no, the Torah empowered the Chachamim, the Torah empowered the rabbis. Shalavicha ve'geicha, zekeinecha ve'yomelech is a special verse that empowers the rabbis to create rabbinic law. But it's interesting that we don't find them challenging rabbinic law in general, specifically the Neris of Hanukkah. One would expect he could challenge rabbinic law. There's so many rabbinic laws that he could challenge. Why do the rabbis choose specifically the Neris of Hanukkah, the candles of Hanukkah that he poses to? Because when we light the candles, we say, Haneros halalu kodeshe. These Neros are holy. Who made them holy? We could say, Haneros al kikodeshe. These Neros could be treated as if they were holy, kind of act as if they were holy, but we don't say that. We say, Haneros halalu kodeshe. They're actually holy. That's what he's challenging. He's not challenging rabbinic authority to make fences. Rabbis can make fences, but the idea that the rabbis somehow connect, that we, as human beings, can interface again with the Torah and create more holiness. That's what he challenges. But that's really the ultimate, again. The victory of the Greeks is with the Kavish Medachanukah and specifically with the menorah. As we all know that in the Beis HaMikdash, there were many kelim, many vessels in the Beis HaMikdash, each representing or symbolic of something else, the shulchan, the table, prosperity, the mizbeach, sacrifice, the ark, Torah, and the menorah, Torah. And why do we need two specific symbols for Torah? The obvious answer is that the Ark, the Aron, represents the written law, and the Menorah represents the oral law. And being that Hanukkah is a victory that we celebrate because of our interface with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the oral law, it's not a coincidence, again, that the symbolism for the victory is through the Menorah, and that's why in days of yore, when we're able to light the Menorah outside in the street, or in the doorway, we'd actually light the Menorah opposite the mezuzah. The mezuzah being, again, representative of the written law, the menorah, the oral law, and that's ultimately the idea that the oral law illuminates and sheds light on the written law. But that's the ultimate victory of the Greeks, is the Kavish of Hanukkah, that we establish a new holiday. With this adversity, we overcame that adversity, we established a new holiday. The second part, I want to discuss a few moments, is it seems that this Yom Tov also has a very deep part to it. We talk about Yavan, the Greeks, as being Choshech. Darkness doesn't really distort or remove. Darkness just obscures. When you're in a room that's dark, you can't make out the objects. At best, you can make out the Chomer, which is called like the general mass, but you can't really pick up on the Tzura, on the image, on the form. The Yavanim had the same approach to life. They were observers to life, and they saw everything from its superficial chomer, from its mass. But to be able to go beneath, to see deep what's inside, they couldn't appreciate. The idea that the Greeks, again, as scientists, could only deal with the observable. And they would not recognize that there's something beyond. Kedusha, holiness, partnering with holiness. These are all things that they refuse to recognize. They worship Chachma. Chachma, we know, stands for the letters Koachma. It allows us to try to understand what this thing is. But what they didn't understand or appreciate was something called Das. Das means divine wisdom. They appreciated Chachma. They appreciated the idea that there is wisdom in the world, wisdom to understand what they see in front of them. But Das, which means divine wisdom, but also means to connect, to understand how this physical world connects to a deeper world, that's what they refused to recognize. And so they were simply observers in this world, and they only dealt with the observable. I remember many years ago, And one of the programs I run in the summertime, by Shal Shudis, we tend to do a little dancing. And one of the participants was not quite observant. So while we're dancing, he was standing on the sidelines, kind of arms folded like this. And I knew it was important to him to kind of get him to, you know, get involved. So I kind of slipped him into the circle. And he resisted. He said, "Rabbi, one second. I know you want to become observant. So I'm observing." That was his, right? So I told him, "You're making a mistake. That's not our world. We're not observers. We're participants. That, and we're supposed to be participating in this world, connecting with Kadosh Baruch Hu and partnering with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. But that world of a deeper holiness, that's something that the Greeks did not acknowledge. It takes humility. And they didn't have that humility to recognize there might be a wisdom that's beyond their own. We know in Perkei Avos, we're told, Eizul Chacham Haroas HaNolad. Who is a wise person? The one that's able to kind of project in advance. And we're also told, Eizul Chacham Halom Mikolam. Who is a wise person? The one that learns from everybody. The Greeks enjoyed the first kind. Their wisdom was really totally practical. It's all about what wisdom can I learn to help my life become better, improve my lot, improve my life. That's it. It wasn't about, it was totally self-serving. The idea that there's a divine wisdom requires some sense of humility. A loving bikaladam, somebody that's willing to learn from everybody, certainly displays that humility and is able, therefore, to connect to a higher level of wisdom as well. So just to conclude, the Yom Tov of Chanukah, as I said, also embraces this higher level of wisdom. The Gnei Sofer points out quite beautifully that we know, the Gemara tells us, the Talmud tells us there's a dispute, when was the world created? Was it created in Tishrei? Was it created in Nisan? And Tosfos wants to resolve this dispute by saying, what represents the Hirayon, if you will, the pregnancy, or the inception of the world, and one represents the birth, or the world coming to in a very in a practical sense. In Tishrei was the abstract conception, and in Nisan, the world actually came into being. Well, the Gnei points out quite beautifully that if that's the case, we have to take it one step further. Because we know that the world wasn't created on Aleph Tishrei. The world was created 6 days earlier. Adam and Eve were created on Aleph Tishrei. So really the world was created 6 days earlier, which would put us at Chaf Pei El, the 25th day of Elul. We just learned in last week's Parsha, and the Gemara uses this very often, that a woman, we can tell when a woman's pregnant by 3 months. So, if the first day of conception was Chaf Pei Elul, and the first day's creation was Yihi Or, let there be light, it follows that 3 months later, that light is able to come into light, so to speak. And that actually is obviously Chaf Pei Kislev. So the very inception of a light that started out in a very conceived world first comes into this world, so to speak, on Chaf Pei Kislev. So this light, we get a very understanding that this light is a very special light. The Chassam Sofer actually says that Moshe Rabbeinu was told all of the Torah at Har Sinai. But the nister of Torah, the hidden parts of Torah, the mysteries of Torah, the Kabbalah, if you will, of Torah, was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu on Chaf Pei Kislev. So on 20th day of Kislev, it seems, is reserved for the deeper mystical life. So we'll end with this thought. In these weeks' parshas coming up, we have this challenge between Yehuda and Yosef. It's Yosef and the brothers, but it really boils down to Yosef and Yehuda. And to understand that friction between them is to really try to look into a friction that we all, or a conflict that we all actually feel. And that is, every one of us wants to be the best individual we can be. Every one of us wants to be an individual. And every one of us also realizes there's greatness in being part of something greater than ourselves. In a sense, Yehuda-Yosef conflict is a conflict of the individual versus the larger group. Yehuda was a melech, he's a king, he was the uniter. In fact, the word melech backwards spells kulam, the purpose of the king is to unite a larger group. And Yosef represents the quintessential individual, the charming, charismatic individual. And the brothers felt that his individuality had gone too far. And we know that individuality could become an obsession where it's all about yourself. And it says, Vayamer Rachok, they saw from the distance, which means they saw, looking in later generations, there'll be Yerubbams and other people in the history of the Jewish people coming from Yosef that will be very much self-absorbed. And they felt that his individuality, and the way he combed his hair, all those things that he did to show the cloak of the individual, had crossed the line. But the truth of the matter is that the tension between Yehuda and Yosef really reflects the different Yom Tovim of Chanukah and Purim. Chanukah is really the power of the individual. It was Rabban Yatin, with a handful of individuals. There were a handful of candles, so to speak, that illuminate the world. Purim is Leich Kenois Kola Yehudin. There we see it's an effort to kind of gather all the Jewish people together. There the strength was in their numbers, the strength was in a group. But Yosef represents that individual, and Chanukah represents the power of a few individuals to be able to overcome. And the Sfarim tell us, in a certain sense, that the holiness of the individual is powered by an neshama, is powered by a soul, that's actually higher than the holiness that powers Zman, that powers time. You all know that there's certain oils that we can't use that are disqualified from being used on Shabbos, and yet they can be used on Chanukah. And again, the deeper understanding is because those impure oils that Shabbos can't seem to reach, Chanukah can reach. And Chanukah we light in the deepest, darkest days of the month. We light it, you know, on the left-hand side, which is considered impure, under 10 cubits, under 10 hand breadths, which again represents impurity. Because Chanukah is empowered by the soul, the koach of the neshama, which has the ability to penetrate to the deepest part of who we are. It's powered by that special light that we mentioned earlier, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, brought into this world. That special light served this world for 36 hours, as some tell us, and then it was hidden. But in Chanukah, we're able to restore, tap into that very special light, and tap into that within ourselves. It's not a coincidence that there are 36 candles over the course of Chanukah. In fact, there are 36 tractates in the Oral Law. And in fact, that the month of Chanukah begins in the month of Kislev, which stands for Chaf Samach Lamed Vav, or Hidden 36. Because Chanukah is all about those hidden 36 hours, or those hidden 36 lights that we're able to tap into. When we light the candles, we are bringing back that light. When Aaron lit that menorah, he brought back that light, and we replicate and duplicate that as well. We all know when Hashem created the world, he said, Yehi this, and it was that. Yehi this, right? Vayichain, vayichain, and it was so, and it was so. When Hashem created light, it never says vayichain, because that light that he first created, he hid that light. So it never says vayichain. But Aaron restored that light. And that's why when Aaron lit the menorah, the pastor tells him, when he first met, Vayas Kain Aaron, that Aaron brought back that cane that was missing, that wasn't there when Hashem first created the world. He didn't allow it to stay in this world. Aaron brought it back. And every year, Chanukah, we have the power to bring back that very special, powerful light. And it seems to attract all sorts of people that may have no connection to this guy the rest of the year, the certain power to that light. Because that light is powerful enough to probe into the deepest, most impure parts of a person. We make a bracha, Hashem Shana B'Soysa V'Tzivanu. Hashem sanctifies with his mitzvahs, L'Hadlik Ner Chanukah, to light the candle of Chanukah. B'Mitzvosav means his commandments. And even though we know that literally means Hashem gave us mitzvahs, again, the great books tell us that Hashem has mitzvahs too. In fact, it makes perfect sense. If Hashem wants us to emulate him, the mitzvah he gave us is simply a way of emulating what he does as well. So it makes sense to say that Hashem also lights a Chanukah menorah and Chanukah as well. What is his Chanukah menorah? His Chanukah menorah is all of us. When we light our menorah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, reignites each one of our souls with that very deep light and allows us to feel uplifted in a way and to restart. Perhaps over the course of the year, we lost our enthusiasm. Perhaps over the course of the year, we lost faith in ourselves. But Chanukah is an opportunity when we light the menorah. HaKadosh Baruch Hu lights his menorah too. And with a short story that's not really much of a story, I apologize, not much of a happy ending either, but it's something that always left a roshim, an impression on me. There were a number of Jews that were looking to pass the mitzvah, encourage the mitzvah of Chanukah, because as many people as are good, and they were handing out menorahs. This is someplace in Brooklyn. Now, this Russian fellow was sitting, if you're familiar with Brooklyn, there's like a OSHA park where it has these benches with like these tables of, you know, wooden stone tables of chess. And this fellow was sitting on this table, and this younger man went over to him. This yeshiva boy said, "Here's some note. You like to light a note? Here are the candles." And the guy said, "I'm not interested. Just get away." This fellow heard him say, "Oh, maybe I'll try." Right? So he insisted again. He said, "Maybe you wouldn't want this menorah." And the guy said, "I'm really not interested." He said, "Listen, I'm going to leave it over here. I'm not doing anything. If you want to have it and you want to light it, it's your menorah. If you don't, it's not yours." And he left. The fellow didn't say a word. The fellow went around giving menorahs out to other people too. And he decided his curiosity got the better of him. He's curious, what's with this man sitting on a bench? He comes back and he sees the man sitting on a bench, the menorah lit, and tears rolling down his face. I guess we call it the spark in the park, if you will. It was really an opportunity where we saw, I felt firsthand, this kayach of the power of Hanukkah and the power of that very deep light that we all have within each of us, to be able to somehow bring out the best in the darkest of times. What happened to this person later on, I don't know. But I know for that moment for sure, his soul was ignited. And if the Rambam tells us that the mitzvah of Hanukkah is a mitzvah chaviva, it's a precious mitzvah, and he doesn't use that to describe any other mitzvah, and part of it is because something is precious when you have to work hard for it, and we have to work hard for Hanukkah, we have to fight the Yevanim to make it happen, and so it becomes precious to us. There's no doubt that's what the Rambam had in mind when he said it's a mitzvah chaviva. But I would also like to say that a mitzvah chaviva also refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu finds this mitzvah of Hanukkah especially precious to him. When he lights his menorah, he lights us up for a Hanukkah. So let us, you know, engage this special yontif, the special gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us, to tap into that deepest part of holiness that we have, that even when we seem to maybe have lost a little bit of that enthusiasm that we started out the year with, to rediscover it in ourselves, to re-engage in Torah, especially in the learning of Torah. That's where the vibrancy comes out, and we should therefore be zocha to have not just a fulfilling Hanukkah, but hopefully a fulfilling rest of the year as well. A lifting of Hanukkah.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Talzam, for penetrating and enlightening the Vetora Hanukkah presentation. Everybody's invited to go back. We have more delicious food and music and dancing. Chag Sameach. Thank you. I'm listening. I'm ADD, like I'm like 52.
Thank you. I'm glad you just thought of me.